Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Troopers, withdraw!
We heard them say we'd never make it here. We heard them say they'd stop us if it was the last thing they did. We heard them say we don't deserve to be here. But today, we stand as Americans.
How do you make him seem like he's normal, he's regular, he's human?
He was a jester. I mean, it's not a scene in the movie, but one of his favorite things was to put saran wrap over the toilet, knowing someone was about to go to the bathroom.
Hi, I'm Dan Patrick, and this is IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick, an Amazon original. The podcast where I talk to some of Hollywood's top actors, directors, and producers about some of their most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and have even become fixtures in pop culture. Today, we're joined by British-American actor and producer David Oyelowo. David began his acting career in British theater and television, but it wasn't until 2013 when he garnered attention in the United States for his role in Lee Daniels' movie, The Butler. This led him to his highest profile role to date, playing Martin Luther King in the 2014 film Selma. Selma was directed by Ava DuVernay. It made just under $67 million off a $20 million budget. Critical praise was given to Ava's direction and David's performance, yet neither was given an Oscar nomination. On today's show, we're discussing that scene in Selma, where Dr. King leads a peaceful protest march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. The first march, not 3 weeks earlier, was met with extreme violence by the Selma police. Why were you driven to play Martin Luther King in Selma?
I felt a calling to it. It's very difficult to explain it in any other way. In 2007 is when I first read that script, and I just knew to the core of my spirit I was going to play that role. I didn't at that point know that it would take 7 years and there would be another five directors from the one I first auditioned for, and that I would end up having a hand in selecting the actual director who went on to direct it. But it was quite the journey. And even though it was a very frustrating one, timing-wise, I needed those 7 years to get better as an actor, to do the research, to actually really understand the weight of the endeavor I was undertaking. And the significance of him as a figure in America and the world, unfortunately, continued to grow in terms of the social injustice, racial injustice, civic unrest, civil unrest, marginalization, racism, prejudice, all of these things that, as we continue to see, are just so with us in a way that they really shouldn't still be, but they are. And so the film just continued to feel and be more and more potent and necessitous to make.
But you wouldn't have been able to pull this off, you think, in 2007?
I would have done a version of it that I hazard a guess would not have been as layered, as potent, as deep, as mature as I eventually did it. You couldn't have told me that at the time. I was ready. You know, I was ready to go. But you know, I really felt there was a sort of a divine intervention. Also, I think the film was waiting for the right director. You know, Ava DuVernay, in my opinion, I just can't think of anyone on planet Earth who would have told that story as lovingly, gone as granular as she did with the storytelling. So I'm glad it took as long as it did, because I do feel the version we have is the best version that could have been.
What was the biggest challenge of that second march across the bridge? Because the first one, Martin Luther King is watching on TV.
Yeah.
So you get set for that second march. What is the biggest challenge for you?
Dan, I have to tell you, it was another surreal day because we shot that scene on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So we were in Selma, Alabama, where that march took place. It had taken place about 50 years beforehand. And so there were people on that bridge with us who had been in that actual crossing of the bridge. They were now in their 60s and 70s. They had been kids at the time. They would introduce themselves to me and say, I was there. And I felt it a point of duty to do this with you today. And that is, again, both amazing and just terrifying. So it was a surreal day of shooting, but historically speaking, Dr. King knew that he wouldn't cross the bridge that day. He knew that he was going to bring the people there and it was going to be something symbolic, but he couldn't tell the people that because they wouldn't do it because they were hell bent on doing the march. He knew that he had not been sanctioned by the judge to do that march, and they could not be in a situation where they were fundamentally breaking the law because it would delegitimize the peaceful march, the fact of going up against oppression in a lawful way in order to bring attention to injustice. And so he had to take a gamble. On the one hand, he knew they weren't going to cross the bridge. He had convinced them that they would be doing something worthwhile. And then there was also this element where he felt so connected to God that he felt, if God tells me to go, I will go, because I do not serve man, I serve God. And so, you know, part of what I was trying to portray on that bridge was this man who clearly, in my opinion, was plugged into something divine. He was following the plan, but he always left space for the divine. And so what I'm trying to transmit as you watch that scene is a man who is both with the people and is talking to his Father in heaven and makes a decision on that basis.
Why was it in Selma?
Well, it was in Selma because it was one of the places that had the worst record in terms of Black people being allowed to register to vote.
It was like 2%, I think.
Yeah, it was one of the places where it was most egregious. Also, it was close enough to Montgomery that you could make a noise. He was a master of media. He understood the power of cameras, and he understood that there are places you would go that the cameras would come, and there are places you would go that the cameras would not. And so it was strategic when they went into a town or a city to protest, a march, a speech, or whatever. It was strategic in terms of the media turning up. And so it was just one of those places. There were already people on the ground who had been organizing for years. So it was, and that's one of the things you see in the film as a point of conflict. There are people on the ground, some of who took umbrage with the fact that Dr. King is just going to show up and be the poster child now for something they had been doing for years. But because of that groundwork that had already been laid in Selma, Alabama, they could be more effective as a result.
I could understand where those who were there experiencing that, and then he's coming in after they've just been brutalized.
Right.
And then he's doing something in a nonviolent way. That had to be hard to convey to these men and women. The last thing they're thinking is nonviolence, I'm guessing, considering what happened to them the first time around.
Well, they had been subjected to violence, obviously, but where the nonviolent approach did work is that all of America watched that footage, and because those marching didn't retaliate, it was a very hard thing to watch because, again, a little bit like what we saw with George Floyd, you had a moment where symbolized by the knee on the neck with George Floyd or the bashing over the head of John Lewis on camera symbolized indisputable injustice, something that should not be happening. Law enforcement, who is there to protect people, are now battering people. And indisputable injustice was being beamed into people's living rooms.
How do you make him seem like he's normal, he's regular, he's human, he has faults?
Yeah, well, one of the things I was very lucky to have is I was playing a character who there were many people alive who knew him and knew him very, very well. And in talking to those people, he was a jester. I mean, well, you know, people, it's not a scene in the movie, but he, one of his favorite things was to put saran wrap over the toilet, knowing someone was someone was about to go to the bathroom. I mean, can you imagine Dr. King, you know, mischievously putting saran wrap before Andrew Young goes to the bathroom? You know, and that was something he would do all the time. But he was also someone who was a reluctant civil rights leader. He feared for his life. He wanted to quit several times, but he didn't, because that calling for him was a very real one. And you know, knowing that he was a person who had real humor, knowing that he was a person who had real fear, knowing that he was fallible even when it came to women, and the fact that he was a superstar wherever he was, and he was not immune to the fact that, you know, women would throw themselves at him as well. These were all things that showed that he was someone worthy of the term icon, but he was also incredibly fallible and human as well.
How do you deal with the pressure of living up to everybody else's expectations?
Well, you don't. You just have to leave that alone.
But how do you leave that alone, though?
One of the things you have to come to terms with very quickly as an actor, as an artist, is that you have chosen to do something that is subjective. You know, if a football player scores however many touchdowns, that is indisputable that they are the greatest quarterback, wide receiver, whatever. But a husband and wife will watch a film. One of them will love it. The other will hate it. They will have fallen asleep during it. That's just the fact of the art form. And so that being just a part of being an actor, period, let alone adding this thing whereby I can't control the fact that I don't look as much like him as you would like me to do. I put on the 35 pounds. I tried. I did as much work as I could. You know, there are some people who are not going to like the fact that I'm British and playing him. I can't control that. I'm the one who has been tasked with doing this. But the one thing you will not be able to accuse me of is the fact that I didn't give it my all. And that's the one thing I can control, and that's something I certainly did.
How do you know you nailed the scene?
You never truly know until you're in a movie theater watching it with other human beings who are who you make it for. But something that you can feel, you know, I'm on set at the moment, we've been shooting this morning, you know when there is a confluence between your preparation, your interaction with the other actors, the crew who are capturing what you're doing, and the way the director says cut. You know, if you hear in that word cut the fact that they feel that they got what they needed, then your job is done. And then, you know, you hope that it all comes together in the edit. And that is even more the case once all the other elements have been added.
So you finish the Pettus Bridge scene. In your mind, do you know that we've done it? Or do you have to be told when you hear cut, then you're good, then you can kind of exhale and move on? That scene is done.
One of the things that is so precious to me about my relationship with Ava DuVernay is that in many ways, she's my creative soulmate. More so than any other director I have worked with understands me and gets out of me things I didn't even know were in me. And so I have complete trust in her when it comes to her opinion as to whether we got it or not. She is one of the few directors, there's a few of them, but she's one of a handful who I feel completely capable and confident to place myself in her hands, because I think her command of story, of character, and of movie making is second to none. And so her being happy leaves me happy.
What did she bring out of you that you didn't know was in you, in that character?
She would push me to places emotionally that didn't require a lot of words. And I think it's because we're actually very good friends. She knows me a lot as a person. We've done a film called Middle of Nowhere together. I fought very hard for her to do this film. You know, we are in each other's lives in a very real way. I consider her a sister to me. She considers me a brother to her. And so there is a shorthand we have as people that translates into the movie making. It's almost something I can't fully explain, but it is definitely beyond what I've experienced with other directors who, you know, hire me to do a job and then we're sort of feeling each other out as we continue to make the film. That is not the case when I work with Ava. We have an unfair advantage in that we know each other incredibly well.
I didn't know that the last scene was the Nobel Peace Prize.
The last scene that I shot, yeah.
Yes. It's almost like you're taking off armor or, you know, a costume. Like when you're done with a character, like what was that like when you know that's the final scene of you playing Martin Luther King?
Well, I think it actually exists on YouTube somewhere. There's footage of Ava calling cut for the last time, me having done the Nobel Peace Prize speech. And I'll be honest, I broke into tears. I had been carrying this thing. I'd felt pregnant with it for 7 years. And there were so many times that I just thought it's not going to happen. There were so many other movies. Steven Spielberg was going to do one. Paul Greengrass was going to do one. There were so many other Dr. King films that seemed to want to come to fruition at around the same time as we suddenly were gaining some traction. And there were many a time I thought this is not going to happen. And so the surreality of it was in the can. We had done it. It was a huge relief and it was an incredibly cathartic moment for me.
I accept this honor for our lost ones whose deaths pave our path. I accept this honor for the more than 20 million American Negroes who are motivated by dignity.
There's a human element to it. It's hard not to see, you know, Dr. King and think that, you know, he's in Washington, D.C., and he's giving these speeches and we can quote them. But to be able to make it seem like I kind of know him, you know, you made him feel like I would know him as a person, not as this person who we would see on TV giving speeches. And I think that's the true testament when I watch the movie is, you made him normal, relatable, human. And I that's hard because I think the big moments, the big speeches, like you can bring all the guns there. I think the hard part was making him seem, you know, just down to earth.
I would agree with you. And I would say that that's in the writing. You know, there was a version of this script early on where it was actually a lot of the political jousting. In fact, there was a version very early on that the lead character in the film was Lyndon Johnson. Dr. King was actually a supporting character. It wasn't until Lee Daniels came on board that changed.
Wait, what was it going to be about Selma through the lens of President Johnson?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And that wasn't unusual at that time in history to tell these kind of stories through a white lens. And the first two directors on the film were two white men. And then it was actually Spike Lee who was going to do it. And then it was Lee Daniels. And it was Lee who shifted it. And it was Ava who actually brought in the women and made it not just about the man, but the movement as well. I mean, there was a script that I had where my only interaction with Coretta Scott King, as played by Carmen Ejogo, was over the phone. I never actually was in a room with her. It was Ava who rewrote it to bring in characters that could be worthy of Tessa Thompson, Oprah Winfrey, Lorraine Toussaint, Carmen Ejogo. And she was also the one who was able to humanize him in a way that you see what you saw, not just the big barnstorming moments, but the quiet moments. In fact, my literal favorite scene in the film is the confrontation between myself and my wife in the film, as played by Carmen, where she confronts me about infidelity. And I think I say two lines in the whole thing, but to see a man famous for oratory reduced to having no words was actually something that I thought was incredibly powerful and revealing.
Some of my favorite moments were you with President Johnson or Martin Luther King with President Johnson, because he's talking about the war on poverty and you're talking about, you know, voter suppression. We want to have the right to vote. That little sparring, those sessions there, how do you nuance that? What is it that you're trying to bring into that where he's meeting with the president of the United States?
Well, when I spoke to Ava about it, she felt the theme, the overriding theme of the movie is overcoming obstacle. Sometimes it is the obstacle of getting over a bridge. Sometimes it's the obstacle of the fact that you have to leave home and you don't want to. Sometimes it's because you have to go and canvass the president of the United States in order to get your point across. There were so many obstacles that Dr. King had to face, obviously, in life, but my character in the film. And one of the things we really wanted to show is that it wasn't an easy political thing for Johnson or Dr. King to get across. You know, one of the least enviable jobs, I think, personally, for me, would be to be the leader of a country. The sheer amount of compromise and the amount of interests of so many different people that you have to consider and juggle and try to be on the right side of is just unfathomable. You know, Lyndon Johnson has so many issues he's having to deal with. Obviously, Dr. King has a very focused agenda, and it's one that we are following through the film. And, you know, that jousting between them is one of those situations where they both have a good point. But at the end of the day, Dr. King is not going to back down. And Lyndon Johnson goes on to pass the Voting Rights Act, but to a certain degree under duress because he had so many other things to have to face. So that was, you know, drama is conflict. And that was certainly one of the points of conflict in the film.
When did you first hear about Martin Luther King?
Oh, gosh. I mean, even though I grew up in the UK as a kid, of course, he's a heroic figure, you know, in the way that Churchill is or Gandhi or Lincoln. You know, he's just one of those figures who, as you go through your education, I think I even remember having a sort of a cartoony book that sort of talked about going from the Montgomery bus boycott all the way to the March on Washington. I remember being aware of him. But I will say, being British, I did not have the same deep knowledge and deep level of connection to him that had I been an African American. And in some ways, it may sound odd, but I think that actually served me in the playing of him, because I think one of the hardest things, if you're playing a historical figure who is so lauded, if you approach it with that mindset, there is a chance that you are not going to fully delve into the humanity of the character and try to play an icon, which is something that is unplayable and something that is unrelatable for an audience. And so I was always very much more invested in showing him as obviously a transcendent character, but also a fallible man.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
How do you channel Martin Luther King as opposed to mimic or impersonate?
That's where those 7 years really kicked in. I think just talking to so many people who knew him, reading every book about him, every article about him I could get my hands on. You know, I come from the school of eat the chicken and spit out the bones. You know, just take in as much as is going to nourish you in order to be able to play the character, and then just trust it. And, you know, those 7 years definitely afforded me a real sort of slow cook time to present something that was, you know, hopefully felt not half-baked.
And somebody that we just lost, John Lewis, and his role, having been there at the marches, leading that first march, how valuable was meeting John Lewis, talking to John Lewis about Martin Luther King?
I was about to do a scene, and I heard over the radio that John Lewis was on set. I started to shake. I was freaking out. Oh, my goodness. You know, half the time as an actor, you feel like a fraud anyway. But then you're playing this character, and then you're going to present yourself to someone who knew him more than most. I stayed in character the full 2 to 3 months that we were shooting. So I stepped out, and there he was. And without even saying hello to me, the first words out of his mouth were, "Dr. King, it is so nice to see you again."
Oh, man.
And that really,
oh, wow.
I barely was able to function after he said that. And I could tell that he wasn't just being cute. You know, he was having a moment as well. So that was very special for me.
Wow. Because you're not expecting that. Like, you're doing your best to stay in character. He's almost in character in 1965.
Right. Right. And we are in Atlanta. And we are going into Wheat Street Baptist Church, which isn't necessarily a church that he was in, but it's a historical Black church in Atlanta, not far away from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. There were so many people in the congregation that day as well who had watched Dr. King give a sermon or had marched with him. So it was both terrifying and also just surreal to meet John Lewis and then go in, because it was the day we did the funeral of Jimmie Lee Jackson. And to have that many people who had known Dr. King there, for me to be channeling him, if you like, was really something I'll take to my grave.
But you had your own voice. You weren't trying to sound like Martin Luther King. Was there any thought about you trying to pick up sort of his cadence, his timbre that he has?
I think you have to tip your hat to it. But actually, if it's an impersonation, I think people get distracted by that. You know, my job is to translate and emit the spirit of him so that you believe that what you are watching is a three-dimensional, fully baked representation of Dr. King. I think that then gives you the license to fully enter into the film, as opposed to thinking, is that how he sounded? Is that how he moved? Is that, you know, I tried to get close to those things, but that was not my focus. You know, I don't look exactly like Martin Luther King. We are making a movie. We weren't even allowed to use his actual speeches because we didn't own the rights to them. So Ava and I had to work on studying his cadence and rewriting speeches that would sound like a Dr. King speech. So even that, you know, there was so much we had to manufacture to kind of feel like you were watching him.
What kind of challenge was that, that you're trying to write a Martin Luther King-like speech or speeches?
There are rhythms to the way he spoke. Some of that was to do with the fact that he was brilliant at using the rule of three. He would start something with his point, he would make that point again partway through, and then he would bring it home with that very same phraseology at the end. So you felt like you had had a three-course meal in listening to anything he had to say. And so those rhythms, those rules that he applied to both his sermons and his speeches were what we added to what we did in the film.
The president doesn't want us to march today. The courts don't want us to march. But we must march. We must stand up. We must make a massive demonstration of our moral certainty. I'm so glad we're here together today. I thank you for standing up. For we shall be victorious in our quest. We shall cross the finish line hand in hand. For we shall overcome. All right.
You had so many from Great Britain in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you had Tim Roth and you had Tom Wilkinson,
Kamran Ajogo, yeah.
And here you are playing this seminal moment in our history.
Yeah.
And you're not even a U.S. citizen at the time, are you?
Not at the time. I am now. You know what? It's so funny you say that, because the film came out in 2015. Obviously, it is showcasing how necessitous it is to vote when you've just seen how hard people fought to vote. I felt like a complete fraud living in America, having played Dr. King and this film about voting. And so the minute I could, I became a citizen in 2016. So I fixed that.
Did you audition for Lee Daniels first?
I did. Wow, you've really done your research, Dan. I auditioned for Lee Daniels, got the role, and as I said, to get this film made was just very, very difficult. And he was worn down, as were the other four directors before him, by the fact that they just kept on telling us, this film is too expensive. white people don't want to have white guilt. Black people don't want to feel black pain. This isn't a film that's going to work internationally. We don't even know that people are going to want to see this kind of film. And so we got worn down so many times by being told that the film was more expensive than it should be. And it wasn't. We were making it for a third of the budget that the J. Edgar Hoover movie got made for.
I think it was $20
million. Exactly, $20 million. You know, there were films of a historical nature that were being made for $50 million, $70 million, sometimes $100 million. I was in Lincoln. I know how much that film cost to make. But for some reason, we just kept on being marginalized on the budget. A genius of Ava is that when Lee moved away from the film and I stayed with the film, she said to the producers, give me a budget number and I will back into that number. I will make it for whatever number you give me. And that therefore eroded the excuses to not make the movie. And it went down when she said that, but then common sense prevailed and it went back up. And thankfully we had someone like Oprah producing who also had deep pockets, who saved us at a time where we needed even more money to get this film right. And so, you know, it took a lot of love and a lot of strategy to eventually get this film made.
Was Oprah always going to be in the movie?
No, she wasn't. I had done the film that Lee and I went on to do instead of Selma was The Butler, you know, when we couldn't get Selma made. And in that film, Oprah and I had played mother and son, and I had told her of this ambition I had of playing Dr. King. I actually showed her a video of myself, an audition video of myself, and she said, I truly believe that is your destiny, and I am going to do everything I can to help you achieve it. When I had managed to persuade the producers to bring on Ava to rewrite and direct this film, we were still struggling to get the film off the ground. And that's when I went to Oprah and called her on her bluff, and I said, "Okay, I think if you sign on, they might just allow us to go make this movie." And it was indeed the case. You know, a studio called her after she signed on to produce it, confirmed that she was involved, and that's how we got the money to go make the movie.
Why doesn't Ava have a writing credit in this movie?
That's a very long story. The short version is that the original writer was promised for some reason early on that no matter what happened, he would have sole writing credit, and chose to keep that sole writing credit despite knowing full well that so much of what ended up in the film was not what he wrote. But that was just one of those litigious moments. But, you know, she has gone on to be and do what she is and who she is. And I would say ultimately a kind of justice has prevailed as she has continued to grow in her prowess.
And it should be mentioned that I think it's Bradford Young is the cinematographer. Like the way it's shot is like all three times on the Pettus Bridge, like they're all into the music is different on each time. Like everything about it is, it's almost like its own little movie short.
Right.
I don't know if that was the goal to do it, but the way it was shot, the music, everything about it, it was three different versions of sort of the same scene.
Again, that's Ava, and she, you know, I had worked with Bradford Young on two other films. We had done Middle of Nowhere with Ava, and I'd done a film called A Most Violent Year with Bradford. He's a genius. There is also, I don't think anyone makes black people look as transcendent as Bradford does on screen, and I've just been so privileged to be in his eyepiece a few times. It is a film I am just floored that I'm in. I remember the first time I watched it and I burst out in tears again because I genuinely think it's just beautifully rendered. And you know, that doesn't happen every day.
When will we be free? Soon and very soon. Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, hallelujah.
How surprised are you this film is even more relevant now?
I wouldn't say I'm surprised. I would say I'm saddened.
Yeah.
But it also makes me so happy that we managed to make it. It was a film at the time, those 7 years it took to make, there had been another nearly 50 intervening years where there hadn't been a film made in Hollywood or anywhere in the world where Dr. King was the center of the narrative. When you think about the fact that he was the only American in the entire 20th century who had a holiday named after him. I mean, we had a film about the guy who invented the window wipers before we had a Dr. King movie, you know, and so that sort of typifies some of the injustice, not only in the world, but in Hollywood itself, the fact that it took so long to get a film like this made. So, and the fact that it's not only relevant, but has become a tool for people to see how long this fight has been going on and how much we need to keep this fight going until things truly change is something that I will be honored, feel privileged and blessed to have been a part of till the day I die.
When does Come Away come out?
Come Away comes out on November 13th. It's going to be in some theaters where they are open and mostly on premium VOD. So video on demand as of November 13th.
What were your thoughts when you first read the script for Come Away?
Well, it's one of those scripts that when I read it, I started to second guess myself and think, was this actually the origin of Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan? Were they always brother and sister? Because it worked so well, the melding of Neverland and Wonderland, that I started to second guess myself. But it was this lady called Marissa Kate Goodhill who had this idea, genius in my opinion, and many people have since asked, is it based on a book? But no, it was just this sort of mashup ideas you had, which really, really works.
I love the imagination, though. Like, we all want to submerge ourselves in fantasy, and these are two great characters and two great stories, but you're a producer in the film.
Yeah.
How much producing did you do?
Well, you know, I never sign on as a producer to anything unless that's going to be a very real thing I do. One of the main things I really loved about the script when I got it was the fact that both someone like myself, my children, other young kids of color who have loved these stories in the past can now really see themselves represented in a true way. You know, those narratives weren't written as race specific, and it's not to suddenly say that Peter and Alice were black kids or anything like that. But in a world of postmodern filmmaking, I think it's a time where we can entertain the idea that any child from anywhere can be the hero of their own story, can be in magical narratives. And so that was one of the things that really made me want to see this thing come to fruition and be done as beautifully as it can, because I know that if I had seen this film when I was 12 years old, it would probably have changed my worldview a little bit more in terms of where I fit in the world.
Again, David, thank you. You made my day. Good luck with the movie, Come Away, coming out next month, and thank you again.
Thank you, Dan. Bless you.
New episodes of IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick are available exclusively on Amazon Music. Please make sure to follow us in the Amazon Music app to get every episode. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick was created, hosted, and produced by me, Dan Patrick. It's also produced by Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody, and executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood for Workhouse Media. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick is a production of Dan Patrick Productions and IMDb in association with Workhouse Media.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.